Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today I'm very pleased to welcome to the programme Dr. Gary Sidley, who is a retired NHS consultant clinical psychologist here in the UK and a member of HART, that is Health Advisory and Recovery Team, which is, and I'm going to quote here from the website, a group of highly qualified UK doctors, scientists, economists, psychologists, and other academic experts, which came together over shared concerns about policy and guidance recommendations during the COVID-19 pandemic. End quote. Since August 2020, Dr. Sidley has been running the Coronababble blog. That's coronababbleblog.com, which I'll probably spell out later, which is a website dedicated to careful critique of government policy during COVID. And he continues to be active today as a freelance writer, trainer, and blogger. Dr. Sidley, thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. It's very good to be speaking with you.
My pleasure, Julian. Thank you for inviting me on.
Thank you ever so much for agreeing, because I've been many times visiting your Coronababble blog over the last few years. I found it very helpful. And so it's very good to be speaking with you. And I'll take the opportunity to spell that out, actually. So it's Coronababble. Coronababble. What's the actual address? Is it coronababble.com?
That's it. Yeah. Coronababble.com.
Okay, well, why did, just before we go on, why did you call it Coronababble?
I'm not sure. I suppose I was looking for a term that might grab attention, and some of the original ideas just sounded very kind of, a bit formal, a bit too academic. And so I wanted to, have a more populist appeal. And of course, you know, you can look at it both ways. Coronababble kind of suggests talking nonsense in some ways. The official sources often have been talking nonsense, but I guess the people who are on the other side of the argument might say that Coronababble is an apt name because I'm talking rubbish as well. I don't know. So I suppose it's a swings and roundabouts thing.
Right, yes, I get the picture. Yes, I thought it might be something like that. Yeah. Oh, very good. It certainly sticks in the mind. Okay, so we're going to be talking about, well, kind of three things mainly today. So you wrote a recent article called Nudges, Nudges Everywhere. We're going to be talking about nudge techniques, which, of course, we talked about on this program, has been talked about a lot. But it's perhaps broader and wider than many of us realise. So we're going to be talking about something to do with how the UK government and other governments, of course, during COVID used their behavioural psychologists to secretly influence public behaviour. So we'll go back over that to some extent. And I want to ask you to what extent you conceive of that behaviour or any behaviour using nudge techniques to be ethical or not. I mean, there's a series of questions to do with that. Very interesting. And thirdly, to do specifically with this paper you wrote, the extent to which nudge techniques are still being used by government today, more broadly, with respect to various areas of public policy. And that's going to be not only interesting, I think, but also quite concerning for all of us, really. We'll get into that in a few minutes. So let me ask you first, Dr. Sidley, a bit more about your background. I understand that you started your career in psychiatric nursing, but then you moved into clinical psychology and then did a PhD, indeed, in psychology. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, I went to university in the late 1970s and graduated with a biochemistry and physiology degree. Oh. So the proper science, right. if you like. But my interest in mental health was always there. So in 1980, I got a job on a local psychiatric ward after I graduated, working as a nursing assistant on an acute psychiatric unit. Then went on to do my psychiatric nurse training in the early 1980s, qualified in 1984, then worked in various positions as a psychiatric nurse up until 1987, when I went off to do my clinical psychology training and qualified in 1989, and then practiced for, I think it was 33 years in total in the NHS. Mm-hmm. That includes the nursing period as well. My doctorate, as you mentioned, was obtained in the year 2000, and that was into looking at some of the psychological underpinnings of suicidal behaviour and self-harm behaviour. And I was lucky enough to get the opportunity to retire early in 2013. Continued to be active in the mental health field after that, mainly campaigning against the dominant model in mental health, which is the biological psychiatry model, the idea that, you know, human distress is primarily caused by some biochemical imbalance, which I think is flawed and very unhelpful. And so I was involved in campaign groups then working to try and change things in mental health. Published a book in 2015 called Tales from the Madhouse, and was happily working away with my campaigning work right up until 2020, when the COVID event commenced. Very quickly, by February, March 2020, I was expressing and writing about concerns about the direction of travel. I viewed it as kind of tyrannical kind of campaign, really, and not too dissimilar from biological psychiatry. And that was the irony, just a bigger tyranny. Biological psychiatry I critiqued because it was very much dominated by medication and chemicals, that it often seemed to ride roughshod over human rights. The drug companies were centrally involved. So there are kind of a lot of parallels in the work I was doing back then and this 2020 onwards COVID event, where I saw very similar threads running through it, albeit on a much larger scale. But sadly, Julian, very few of my mental health campaigners seem to see it quite like I did. A few did, but most were very much pro-narrative. So like many people, it's been unfortunate that some quite long-standing colleagues I'm rather more distant from now, and a couple were, you know, kind of, it became quite adversarial. But on the positive side, I've developed a new set of companions, yes, and colleagues.
Sure.
Swings and roundabouts.
Yes, yes, indeed. I'm just wondering how you're saying about this sort of biochemical approach to psychological issues, and you said how you saw some parallels. And one of the things that sprung into my mind that concerned me in the very early days was what we were being told was, you know, we've got this so-called pandemic and we've got a lockdown, etc., and the only way out of it was to wait for the so-called vaccines. That was a red flag to me quite early on. It was, oh right, so this is the only solution. Did that chime with you with respect to what you were saying?
Yes, most definitely. I've researched very deeply over the last few decades into the often egregious acts of the pharmaceutical companies. I think they certainly deserve the tag as being the most corrupt industry in the world. And that's not just hearsay and conspiracy. That's just based on what they've actually been found guilty of.
Right.
The conviction sheet is very, very long, predating COVID, for, you know, distorting evidence and bribing stakeholders, not the actual word used in the criminal case, bribing stakeholders. No, they have a long, long history. So I was suspicious of their kind of involvement and the power that they wield. Because, as you're probably aware, you know, a lot of our institutions are very much dependent upon big pharma money. But I think there are other reasons as well why I became concerned about the COVID event. Having worked in mental health, sometimes alongside those colleagues in the infection control departments, particularly when I was nursing, my sense was that on many occasions, although they were well-meaning, they could be, let's say, monofocused, could not see the bigger picture, and some of their guidance was, shall we say, a little bit unrealistic. I was also mindful, like you say, a big pharma, but also as well around risk and risk aversion. It's one that was a topic I was particularly interested in my doctorate, and I was very aware of how poor we generally are at comparing different levels of risk and weighing them up, and how risk aversion can be a very destructive thing when we're trying to eliminate every possible risk involved in our day-to-day life.
Yes, and we've had this big time, haven't we, this not understanding the full scope of risk with all these lockdowns and trying to avoid one risk and giving rise to a risks that were arguably even more serious. A massive amount that we could discuss in that area alone. Let's return to this issue of the nudge techniques, which, as I say, people will be familiar with, but I do think it's really important to go back over some of this to some extent before we get on to the fact that this is much broader than perhaps many of us realised. So let's go back to the use of these techniques and the use of the behavioural psychologists during COVID. I think perhaps we should start with a definition of nudge. This is something that was popularized, I believe, by the book by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein, best-selling book, Nudge, caught on and influenced policymakers, indeed. So how would you define nudge for us today?
Well, nudge, I would say, probably the most straightforward definition, a layperson's definition, would be that it's a range of psychological techniques of persuasion that often act below our level of conscious awareness. These are means of trying to change other people's behavior, where these techniques act upon their targets in a way that the targets are often unaware that they are being influenced. So they're being covertly shaped in their behavior. The Mindspace document from 2010, which you mentioned, this was the year that the Behavioural Insight team, sometimes referred to as the Nudge Unit, came into existence in the Cabinet Office of David Cameron back in 2010. And this Mindspace document was published alongside that. One of the co-authors of the Mindspace document was Professor David Halpern, the kind of chief of the Behavioural Insight team, the Nudge Unit. And in the Mindspace document, they talked about nudges being kind of behavioural strategies, and I'll quote now, that achieve low-cost, low-pain ways of nudging citizens into new ways of acting by going with the grain of how we think and act, unquote. So that was their conception of what nudge was, these techniques that exploit the way that our kind of minds work. And it might be useful, Julian, just to very briefly talk a little bit about fast brain and slow brain without getting too technical, but I think it is quite a useful characteristic.
Yeah, indeed. That would be great, actually. Just before you do that, can I just clarify, because I think a lot of people will be thinking in terms of propaganda. Now, the two things are very, very close together. But would you agree that propaganda, I'm thinking here of what Jacques Ellul wrote about propaganda, you know, the propaganda is still to do with trying to change behavior, but it typically does so by going through the mind, whether these are fallacious arguments or whatever, just through the mind to try and change behavior. Whereas nudge tends to be more direct by changing your environment. For example, just putting lines on the floor so that you move in one way rather than another. You see an arrow on the ground, so you go that way. Changing the context in which you make decisions. So in some ways, it's even more direct and more insidious, really, because you don't even know what's going on. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, to some extent, I think. And I suppose the way I see behavioral science strategies or nudges is that it's one element of the propaganda machine.
Right.
Now, there are a lot of other techniques that are used and are continuing to be used to silence or shape the views of the general population, which is one of them. But obviously alongside that, there's unprecedented levels of censorship, people being cancelled and smeared, selective information being broadcast via our mainstream media, etc., etc. So it's one element. I don't want to overstate the importance of behavioral science. It is just one kind of weapon in the armory,
yes,
of propagandists, but it's an important weapon.
Yeah, so you were telling us about these two aspects of thinking. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, just very briefly, and this is obviously oversimplification, but the way the mind works can often be viewed as being in two parts, a fast brain, sometimes referred to as system one thinking, and a slow brain, system two. The fast brain, system one brain, is effortless. It's got pretty much limitless capacity. It happens automatically. Essentially very useful for allowing us to cope with the complexities of life, because what it means is that the large majority of decisions that we make in our day-to-day life are done without any deliberative thought. We do them automatically. So, for example, if somebody asks you, what's 2 plus 2? You wouldn't have to use your deliberative brain. Mm. You would immediately give the answer.
Five these days. I'd have to say five. Yeah, go on. Yeah.
If you were driving on a quiet road that you were very familiar with, for most of the time, you'd be in fast brain. You'd be on automatic pilot. Mm. And also some of those subtle things like picking up a kind of aggressive edge in a friend's tone of voice would probably be the fast brain. So we have this kind of fast brain that's limitless in capacity, effortless to use, and in control most of the time. And that's opposed to the slow brain, which is the deliberative thinking bit, which is the conscious thinking things through, which is effortful, very limited capacity, often described as lazy, as we try and minimize wherever possible. So if somebody asks, you know, what's 27 times 38? You would probably have to use your deliberative type 2 thinking, your slow thinking, to be able to the answer.
And that's what we'd normally expect a public representative to be, you know, on TV or something, appealing to our reason and making a case. But so system 1, this is all the automatic stuff. So this is going on with the nudges rather than system 2, where you're being addressed as a rational human being so that you can make a reasonable decision about things.
Well, that's right, Julian, yeah. And the thing is, we are on automatic pilot, type 1, fast brain thinking, 99% plus of the time, probably 99.9% of the time. And that's what the behavioural scientists exploit, because we're continually using these heuristics, these rules of thumb, these shortcuts to make our moment-by-moment decisions, which, as I said, is very useful, because if we didn't do that, we'd be paralysed with indecision most of the day. And let's be fair, most of the time our fast brain gets things right.
Sure.
You know, if I leave my house this evening and there's 200 people running and screaming, all running in the same direction, I'm going to find myself following them, because my fast brain has made that decision, that will probably be a wise decision more often than not.
Yeah. Yes. So the natural endowment of this mental faculty is actually useful, but the problem here is that it's been identified and tapped and misused as something that can be powerfully manipulated. I mean, this is the problem with this, isn't it? And of course, again, I just say that what you're saying here is something that's out in the open. I mean, I have on my browser here a very famous article. David Halpern is one of the authors. It's called Influencing Behavior, The Mind Space Way. I'm sure you're completely familiar with this article in the Journal of Economic Psychology. And they discuss exactly this, System 1 and System 2, the different ways of thinking and how the reflexive, controlled, effortful, rule-based, slow, conscious, rational thing is what we normally think of. But there's the other one, where automatic, uncontrolled, effortless, associative, fast, unconscious, and effective might be useful for, well, basically manipulating people with respect to government policy. And it's there. Anybody can go and read that article.
Yes, it's all in plain sight. There's the original Mindspace documents and the various many other articles that spawned. They're all out there. This is not make-believe. You know, this is not
Absolutely, because as I said to you before the interview, I have heard people saying, you know, the Mindspace document is a conspiracy theory, which, well, there you go. No, it's not. Go and read it for yourself. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. How influential was this book, Nudge, by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein? I mean, you got a quote from some PR person saying that it was very influential. Is that representative of the industry?
It's very influential, but there's been another number of key players. The Mindspace document is arguably the most cited document, I think, in the UK nudge literature. But nudge does go back quite a long time, at least to the 1940s. It just gained impetus and accelerated in 2020, the onset of the COVID event. But it's been around for a long time, and obviously used in industry and in by private companies and sales as well. These same techniques are quite ubiquitous. But it's what changed in 2020, I think, was the intensity and the breadth of its use, particularly by the state, which I think puts it in a completely different domain.
Yes. And of course, it had taken root, as you said before, in 2010 with the UK Cabinet Office starting the Behavioural Insights team. And it was around that time. This is the quote that you have for one of your pieces by a PR person called Julia Bainbridge from, I think it's Freud's. Yeah. And she was talking about how Richard Thaler was giving a lecture about his book, and They loved it, she said. There's a good quote here. We loved it. To rapturous applause, people rose from their seats to tell Thaler how his book, his speech, his ideas had made them think about communications and behaviour in an entirely different way. The paradigm had shifted. So obviously at that point, there was a shift. There was a lot of interest in this. But as you say, 10 years later, it kicks into that high gear, doesn't it?
That's right, yeah. And Bainbridge goes on to say that now it's kind of embedded in the advertising agencies, one of their core methods. And the agency that she works for, which is Freud's, is one that the government do commission on a regular basis, I believe. The advertising agency centrally involved in the Look Them in the Eyes campaign was a different one called Mullen-Lowe. But there's no reason to believe that they will be any different with regards to their personnel and their methods.
Yes, I remember that campaign. It's very affective and effective. as a look at it, you do feel guilty, which I presume is what it's trying to induce, really.
Yes, I think the added shame to the previous reliance on fear inflation to make people feel shamed and guilty if they should deviate from the dominant narrative and the restrictions that were being passed down from government.
Yeah, we'll come on to the ethics of all this in a few minutes. Now, the other thing was Spy B that was very famous. So the Scientific Pandemic Insights Group on Behaviours, I believe, which was a subgroup of the famous SAGE, which is Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies. Now, David Halpern was part of this, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. This was a subgroup of SAGE that came into existence.
And this was the... Okay, so this was the Mindspace document, came from them, is that correct?
No, no.
Oh, okay.
David Halpern was one of the co-authors on Mindspace. There were, I think, another four authors.
Okay.
And David Halpern is the lead of the Behavioural Insight team, otherwise known as the Nudge Unit.
Yeah.
David Halpern also sat on the SPIB, the SAGE subgroup.
Uh-huh.
He was a member, along with many others, including very prominent behavioural scientists.
Okay, so let's go. I got the wrong publishers of this, but the same sort of crew, the same sort of set here. So, okay, so the Mindspace document itself is in fact an acronym, isn't it, of various aspects of Nudge that can be employed by government to achieve various policy outcomes. So each one, MINDSPACE, stands for a different approach, a different set of techniques. Could you give us an idea of what those are? I know you concentrate on four of them, but what's the full list?
Right, yeah. Well, you'll probably test my memory now because behavioural science is riddled with acronyms of this type, and which is quite confusing because it means that some similar techniques come under different labels.
Yes, yes. A bit unfair of me, actually, just to say it like that. So let me say what they are, and perhaps you can give us an idea of what each one has to do with. So the first one of Mindspace is M, obviously, messenger. What's that all about?
Yeah, messenger's about the source of the information will have a significant impact on whether it's heeded or not. So, for instance, if the source is an authoritative one, somebody who's perceived as an expert, or if it comes from a source that sounds very much like ourselves, so like a regional accent that corresponds to Lancashire in my case, you know, somebody with a Lancashire accent, if the source has those kind of qualities, then the idea is that it will be much more likely to be taken seriously and heeded.
And that's backed up by research, presumably.
Yes, yeah, but I suppose in the COVID event, it was, you know, when you're looking at how it was put into practice, then the daily press conferences where experts, you know, Vance and Whitty, you know, were giving the information. They were viewed as being sources that were reliable, top of their profession kind of thing. The NHS logo, because it's highly trusted, or was, and perhaps a bit less so these days, you know, the NHS logo was everywhere. A lot of the adverts, for example, the ones pushing masks, you remember, you know, I wear my covering to protect my mates, that kind of thing. That was done in different regional accents.
I noticed that, actually. Yes, it depends what you're trying to say and which audience you're trying to address as to what you might choose. I remember a nurse, I think she was talking about COVID injections or something. And yes, she had a very friendly, well, she probably wasn't even a nurse. She was somebody playing the part of a nurse in this advert. And she was very, very friendly and down to earth, like the person next door, and a regional accent. And I thought, oh, to me, anyway, it was just obvious that was manipulative. You know?
Yes, and I suppose suppose the other three, there's a lot of these nudges, but yeah. In addition to the messenger, there's another three that I'd like to highlight, really, because I think
yes.
These are the ones that are ethically questionable in a big way. And of course, yes, these correspond to your mind space letters. The E in mind space is for ego, ego nudge, which exploits the fact that we all strive to maintain a positive self-image. We like to view ourselves as a good, decent, virtuous person.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened in the COVID event was that a lot of the messaging suggested that following the restrictions and taking the vaccine was akin to being a good person.
Mm.
You know, that's what virtuous people did. And obviously the reverse of that is that if you didn't do that, you're in the bad person box, which is not a comfortable place to be. So your mantras like stay home, protect the NHS, save lives is an ego-informed nudge. Because, you know, saving the NHS and saving lives is obviously a worthy thing to be doing. Vaccinations protect us all is another kind of ego nudge. Because, you know, if you don't go for vaccination, you are putting other people at risk. So the argument went.
Mm.
You know, no one is safe until we're all safe. Don't kill your gran, as Matt Hancock infamously recorded saying. So that's the ego.
Yes. One of the- yes, there were some others, weren't there? I wash my hands to protect my family. You know, not
that's what?
It's a good idea to wash your hands, but no, it's got this moral dimension to it which makes you feel good if you do it and bad if you don't. Same with
yes.
I make space to protect you. I remember that one. I found that offensive, actually, you know. I make space to protect you. These are just lines on the ground. You know, how dare you manipulate me like this? This is something to do, you say, with something called fundamental attribution error.
Yes.
Is that what you...
Yeah.
What is that? How does that go?
This is, again, one of the many cognitive biases that we all have, which is a tendency to attribute positive outcomes to ourselves and negative ones to other things.
Other things and other people. Right.
If I get a glowing... result for a university exam, I'm more likely to attribute it to my hard work, intelligence, etc., etc. Whereas if I kind of fail badly at the exam, I'm rather more likely to attribute it to a bad lecture, you know, a bad lecturer,
right,
or that
right.
The exam particularly difficult that year.
I see. Yes. Yeah. And of course, that might be true. But you're saying there's a bias here to do that, so that you will make errors like this, even when it's not true. That kind of thing.
That's right. Yeah. So to maintain self-esteem, really, to maintain our positive self-image.
Yes.
We've mentioned messenger, we've mentioned egos. Those are two, just very quickly, if I may, Julian. I think one.
Please do.
One is affect, which is the A in mind space, which is about emotion. And this could be any emotion, how that impacts on the way we make sense of our world. The most relevant aspect of that is of course, fear inflation.
Mm.
When we're frightened, we process information in a very different way. So we tend to focus on threatening things in our environment. Our memory to past frightening events becomes much more kind of impactful, and we're inclined to interpret things in a much more threatening way. So it's kind of self-propagating in a way. So when somebody is in a state of high affect, particularly fear, they are more likely to see danger where danger isn't necessarily there.
Is this the mood congruence thing? Is that the one?
That's right, yes, that's right.
Right.
You know, again, there are multiple examples during the COVID event, you know, the daily death stats that were
yes.
on our screens, yes. the images of very acutely unwell patients in intensive care units, you know, bodies in the streets of Wuhan and Ecuador, or, you know, on and on. Mm. The stats, particularly, I always thought was a rather egregious
statement. Yes. That's right. Every day on primetime TV, it was terrifying. And I think a lot of people were absolutely scared out of their wits by this.
Yeah, quite. You know, and non-contextualized. You know, they always failed to mention, for example, that every day in the UK, on average, 1,600 people die every day in the UK. So, you know, when you were seeing these kind of death counts coming up, without putting it into some kind of perspective, Also, without talking about how indiscriminate the PCR test was, with massive false positives. We're in a period of time, Julian, where if you died within a fortnight of a positive PCR test, you went down as a COVID death. So in other words, that test positive on this rather dubious test, which, like I said, was far from accurate, and then was involved in a road traffic accident 10 days later and died, I'd go down as a COVID death.
It was absurd. And for anybody who was thinking about it, as you were, as I was, many people were, but not the majority, I think, you started to think, well, none of this really means anything anymore. You know, these words are being used and they're scary, but what does any of it mean? But if you're not thinking rationally about it, if you're just encouraged to be fearful, then these are just going to go straight through, presumably into a portion of, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but a portion of your mind where you're just reacting rather than thinking about what does it mean. There was a very famous thing, you bring this up, where Valance and Witte quoted, I think it was a prediction of 50,000 new cases, because there's another thing, isn't it? Cases rather than deaths. 50,000 new cases per day are on the cards, you know, soon. And that was pretty terrifying.
It was. And it was kind of modelling at work there, wasn't it?
Right.
So modelling play a disproportionate role, in my view, in some of the predictions. The idea that, you know, if you assume the worst and assume a rather distortedly high fatality rate for the SARS-CoV-2 virus and then feed that into your equations, then the model inevitably comes out with these worst scenarios, you know, which predict all these many, many deaths and many, many infections, which we knew from an early stage was, you know, were grossly inaccurate, but they kept on pushing them. And just very quickly, the other nudge, which I think is an ethically dubious one and was used widely, is the normative pressure, the norms.
Yeah, before you do that, I've got to just remind people about that. Now, I want to check with you. Was it the SPY-B meeting in 2020 where they say there wasn't enough fear? They needed the threat to be, the perceived level of threat needs to be increased. Was it them that did that?
Yes, that was the SPIB subgroup in their minute of March 2020, which was one of the most kind of blatant examples of fear perpetuation and the affect nudge.
Yeah, I just had to bring that up because, obviously what they said was heeded.
Yes, right. Interestingly, they've kind of denied since then that that was actually advocating the use of fear.
Oh, okay.
Which is rather plausible, really. You know, as you said, a substantial number of people still do not feel sufficiently personally threatened. The perceived level of personal threat needs to be increased among those who are complacent, using hard-hitting emotional messaging, unquote. I don't think you get any clearer than that, really.
No, I'm not sure what otherwise you would do, really, to bring that about. Yeah, okay. Yeah, go on then. So norms, what's this?
Yeah, normative pressure is like, again, exploits the fact that we don't want to be in a minority or believe ourselves to be in a minority group. It's quite uncomfortable to think that what we believe or how we behave doesn't correspond to what the majority of people are doing.
Yeah.
It exploits that inherent desire to follow the crowd, even though sometimes it might be going off the edge of a cliff, of course. But for example, you'd hear things like, over 90% of adults have already been vaccinated, which seems to find out to be untrue, as it turns out, but that's kind of giving the impression that everybody else is doing it.
Right.
98% of people are fully on board with the restrictions.
Yeah, most people are following the rules. And yeah. I think there was a lot of footage, wasn't there, of people disobeying the rules. And, of course, a lot of condemnation of those people. You know, they were on the beach or something. Oh, these selfish people on the beach. So I suppose that's the sort of flip side of it, achieving the same thing. That you say, oh, well, that's how you shouldn't behave.
Yeah, you're getting into the ethical aspects there, aren't you? Because inevitably, if you... if you kind of highlight this minority group of people who are deviating from the norm and then via the ego nudge label them as bad individuals, it's hardly surprising that you then get this vilification of these minority groups, whether they be people who've opted not to take the vaccine or whether it's people who are not wearing masks or whether it's people who are not kind of following the restrictions. Kind of not rocket science, that is it? You know, that if you
Yeah, yeah.
So those were the most ethically dubious nudges then, I'd say, Julia.
Okay, yeah, so let's not go through them all. Okay, so the ethical question, let's move on to that. Now, interestingly enough, you wrote a letter early in 2021. You and I think it was 47 co-signatories, this letter to the British Psychological Society Ethics Committee, and you were asking them to respond to some questions that you had about the ethics of what happened during COVID, whether their code of ethics had been followed or not by members that had to do with this society. Can you tell us what you asked them?
Yes, in brief, we put it to them that there were members of their organisation, talk about the British Psychological Society now, which is the professional body that is tasked with overseeing the practice of all psychologists in the UK. Mm. Now, of course, some of the prominent behavioural scientists are also prominent members of the British Psychological Society. Mm-hmm. So Professors Susan Mickey, Stephen Riker, Robert West, they're all British Psychological Society members. Mm. And of course, like any other professional body, they have a code of ethics. And so we wrote to them saying they're championing these methods, these nudges, and we think that they are ethically dubious to, be covertly influencing the populace without their explicit consent, using techniques that strategically, i.e. deliberately, increase emotional discomfort to achieve their goal. We put it to the British Psychological Society that those are pretty dubious activities on an ethical basis. And the other element of the ethical questioning, of course, is around contentious goals, to say the least. Lockdowns, pretty non-evidenced, counterproductive, masks for healthy people, never done before. So using these techniques surely raised ethical kind of questions that you would have thought that the professional would have been very interested in.
Yes.
Which, because long story short, Julian, they came back in strident staff, right, really, defending their psychologists, saying they were doing a wonderful, wonderful job,
right,
that consent wasn't needed,
right,
because this was on a population level.
Oh, yes.
Suggesting that people's level of fear was perfectly rational, to the objective risk posed by the virus, and saying that their psychologists were all behaving in a, and I quote, socially responsible, unquote, way. So that was their kind of attitude back in 2021.
Right.
And as far as I'm aware, hasn't really changed since.
Oh, has it not? Has it not? Yeah, I noticed that they seemed, in a way, to avoid your point about fear and scapegoating, because I thought you were making the point that they'd been involved in stirring this up. And they kind of ignore it, saying, well, it was a difficult time. No wonder people were scared. And that's not the point. That's not what you were saying, was it?
Well, no. And the individual psychologists involved, they try and defend themselves by saying they weren't scaring people. No, they weren't inflating fear. What they were doing is giving people a realistic appraisal of the risk that they were exposed to.
All right, 50,000 deaths a day.
Well, exactly. That's one of the most ridiculous parts of their response, really, because the evidence that we were an overly scared population is pretty overwhelming.
Oh, yes.
Back in 2021, there's a professor guy called Spada, works in one of the London universities, who researched this in depth and estimated that somewhere in the region of around 60% of the population at one point had levels of anxiety that were in the clinical range, that were the kind of range that you'd be seeking psychological treatment for, and people just grossly overestimating how many people had died from COVID. Mm. I think at one point it was not uncommon for the average person in the street to think 7 million UK citizens had already died. Mm. So this idea that the population were not overly scared is just total nonsense. It's overwhelming.
Absolutely, and in so many ways, and just one that's popped into my mind, of people wearing masks outside, nobody around them for yards and yards and yards, and this will be months and months after COVID is no longer a thing anymore. Obviously, with this legacy of fear living with it.
That's quite. Yeah, so don't get me started on masks.
No, right.
Yes. Second to do that. All I'd say about masks at this point, very quickly, mm-hmm. is that masks, as well as having very little robust evidence to favour them and a whole range of harms, but one of the key things for our discussion today is that the masks strengthen three of those nudges. Mm-hmm. They perpetuate fear. Wearing a mask perpetuates fear. Mm-hmm. They also strengthen into the ego nudge, because it's a way of people to demonstrate their virtue. We can spot the good guys and the bad guys. And of course, it's very powerfully enhances normative pressure, the norm nudge, because you can instantly differentiate between those individuals who are the rule followers and those individuals who aren't. Mm. And I'm sure I'm not on my own, and I can say, if you want to experience directly what normative pressure to conform can feel like, is just try going without a mask in a room packed full of masked individuals. It's not a comfortable place to be.
No. And indeed, as I've said on this program many times, that was the time when it really hit me that I was being told I had to, by law, put that wretched mask back on. And I was thinking, I've got to this point now where I'm totally aware that this is a signaling device. It's got nothing to do with viruses going in and out of the fabric. It's a signaling device. And at that point, I just couldn't do it on a matter of principle. I'm surprised that so few people seem to realize. Well, I suppose a lot of people did realize that's what it was at the time, but not everybody, unfortunately.
Yeah, so
we're running out of time here, but I did want to ask you whether you think nudge awareness is something that's always wrong for government with respect to their policies. I mean, something that Thaler and Sunstein say in their book is that, we can't say these insights should never be used because, you wouldn't want people to learn that they shouldn't walk in front of a bus, but just by experiencing it, it'd be better to have a sign at the side saying, watch out for the bus, So presumably there's a case for some level of nudging.
Yes, I agree. And also from a realistic perspective, the gene is well and truly out now. So, I think even if we wish to eliminate these things, that's not going to happen. Hmm. But I think what we can do is look at these more ethically dubious ones, like fear inflation, like shaming, like scapegoating through normative pressure, and really try and put some constraints on the government's use of these things.
Yes.
Because I think there are some major ethical issues surrounding them. Mm. And I think what we need to look at is things like four things, really, very quickly. Methods. I think there's a question of, should our government be using these strategies which strategically inflate emotional discomfort in their targets? Should our government be using those kinds of strategies to get us to follow rather dubious goals? Yeah. And of course, you get into that one even more with the methods, because the collateral damage, for want of a better phrase, that the fear generated, for example, that's can a whole raft of negative consequences in itself, with people being too fearful to attend hospital with non-COVID.
Oh, yes.
People dying of loneliness, people in care homes being deserted by the care staff because they were too terrified to stay with them. There's plenty of documented evidence of that. So the whole range of things. I think we have to look at the methods. Mm. Secondly, I think we have to look at consent. Even David Alpin in the Mindspace documents and in his Inside the Nudge Unit book states very explicitly that these techniques should not be used without the explicit permission of the British public. He says that in his writings. Right. And yet none of this was discussed, or there were no kind of open democracy kind of attempts or anything. And the goals, I think, are the third area. You were asking before, are these techniques ever acceptable? Well, I think personally, I think yes, they probably are. If we're using these techniques, for instance, to try and reduce the likelihood of young men stabbing each other, using violence and gang-related stuff, then I think probably, I'm guessing, but I think most people in the country would probably think, yeah, fair enough, that's fine. Mm. But to be used in the pursuit of these contentious, non-evidenced, and potentially hugely destructive goals, masking, lockdowns, school closures, etc. I think it is ethically cruel.
Yeah, I think that's actually what you said there. That chimes with something, again, going back to the book by Thaler and Sunstein, it chimes with something there. You say, you know, this idea that, you ask people, they would probably say, no, I don't think that's a good idea. That's going too far. This is one of the principles they bring up. They call it the publicity principle. Let me just, it's just one sentence here. The publicity principle bans governments from selecting policy that it would not be willing to defend publicly to its own citizens. Now, that sounds to me like quite a good principle there. Would you be willing to defend this publicly? That's a good question to ask, I think. What do you think?
Yes, maybe. I just think some debate of any kind about the ethical these things would be good. And as you demonstrated when you asked me about the British Psychological Society, there has, over the last few years, since the start of the COVID event, been this quite extreme reluctance to even discuss these approaches, to even question them. Not just the British Psychological Society, but various key individuals and the prominent behavioural scientists don't seem to want to debate the ethics of these things.
Right.
We tried later on in 2021 to get the, again, I can't remember what the name of the committee is now, the acronym was PACAC, which is like a cross-party group of MPs who do these in-depth independent inquiries. We actually formally asked them to do one on the ethics of state-funded nudging, but they declined. You know, the COVID-19 inquiry, the terms of reference, have no mention whatsoever of behavioural science or indeed messaging at all within its remit. You know, so there is this real active avoidance of the topic. So some open debate, including sides, you know, would be welcome.
It would be welcome, actually, to have it on a national level, a parliamentary debate about it, so that it's completely in the open as to what people consider to be acceptable for government to be doing, their representatives, indeed, to be doing with respect to the citizenry, I think. I know you could argue, well, that would then undercut the effectiveness, but I'm not sure that's true. I think there would be a sufficient distance between, you know, the policy that was actually being enacted and the debate that was being had. But I think, you know, if people had the opportunity really to understand this and object and have input to it, I think it might make it slightly more palatable.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. And if I could, in the last few minutes, I would like, if it's okay, Julian, just to mention the research that I've been doing into this recently.
It's what I wanted to ask you next, so please do. Oh. These nudges are everywhere. Go on, give us an idea of this.
Yes, I'm halfway through a research project at the moment, which is looking into where the responsibility lies for the tone and content of some of the more scary COVID adverts. And we focused in particular on the Look Them in the Eyes campaign, which I'm sure many of your listeners will remember.
Yeah.
They were pretty harrowing, showing close-ups of dying patients in hospital with full protective gear on, a voiceover ominously saying things like, look them in the eyes and tell them you're doing everything you can to reduce the spread of coronavirus. You know, so these were really kind of shaming, fear-evoking adverts. So we've been digging into who's responsible, and I'm pleased to say we got the paper published in the Self and Society Journal, which is a journal of humanistic psychology here in the UK. Which I'm quite excited about, so, you know, publishing the results. Maybe I could forward you the link to that later, Julian. And
please do.
It's very detailed, but some of the headlines, just very, very quickly, from that research. Key finding one, nudges are everywhere in the United Kingdom. They are not just in the advisory groups like the SPIB, not just in the nudge unit, the Behavioural Insight team, but they're embedded in certainly the large majority of government departments within the UK government infrastructure. They are embedded in the Government Communication Service, which is another entity with 7,000 paid communicators. And they're embedded in the advertising agencies that are contracted in. So they're everywhere. And
right.
You know, for example, there's 24 fully-fledged behavioural scientists at the moment who are employed within the UK Health Security Agency. Back in 2019, there were 54 in the Revenue and Customs.
Right. Yeah.
So every aspect of our life, whether it's travel, because there's some in the Department of Transport as well, whether it's travel, whether it's health, whether it's filling in a tax form, whatever, we're being furtively influenced by our own government, yes. which I think is worth bearing in mind.
It is, and yes, and they actually have these units and teams within their department called the Behavioural Science Team, or Behavioural Scientist, Behavioural Science and Insights Unit, actually within these departments, don't they?
That's right, yes, they're in-house. So it's not just the advisors we see during the COVID event, or not just the Behavioural Insight Team who are contracted in, and were contracted in a big way during the COVID event, multi-million pound contracts. But in addition to that, we have all these in-house nudges. Yeah. You know, yeah. They are literally everywhere. Some of the other key findings, which I'll go through very quickly, we managed to identify which key individuals were responsible for the look them in the eyes videos and posters. For instance, the senior civil servant was a guy called Conrad Bird, who's a director of campaigns and marketing at the Cabinet Office. The actual behavioural scientists, interestingly, directly responsible for the look them in the eyes, weren't the SBIB or the Behavioural Insight Team. It was the Cabinet Office in-house resource, small team of behavioural scientists operating from the Cabinet Office. Mm. As we've mentioned, the Mullen Law was the advertising agency that was involved in putting them together. And perhaps unsurprisingly, the minister who signed off, and therefore, I guess, was ultimately responsible for the Look Them in the Eyes campaign, was, everybody will have guessed it, Matt, W. Granny Hancock, he was the ultimate sign-off. Even though, the prominent behavioural scientists like David Alpern and Susan Mickey were all claiming that they'd never use fear and they never use these unethical nudges, if you actually sift through, which we did, all their documented outputs during the COVID event, I'd argue there's overwhelming evidence that they did encourage the use of all the key unethical nudges that I've mentioned. Well, this is the thing, Julian. The fourth major finding, because this I found astonishing, and I've been researching this for a long time, was the actual Cabinet Office justifications for unleashing the look them in the eyes materials, which they knew in their own words were harrowing, gripping, disturbing, those are words that they used. They knew,
right.
And the actual justifications included the existence of a so-called, and I quote, complacent minority.
Aha.
Unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that younger people perceive themselves to be at less risk, which of course
they were,
yeah, factual assumption.
Yeah.
And thirdly, this idea that in January 2021, which was around the time of the second lockdown and the time at which the Look Them in the Eyes campaign was launched, the levels of fear in January 21 were not as high as they were in March 2020.
Mm-hmm.
People were still fearful, it says, but they were less panicky. And that was one of the justifications for unleashing these kind of disturbing
acts, yes,
upon all the British people. And you have to remember, we're talking probably there then that the majority of British people are already overly scared by this point.
Right, right. Which goes back to your point that there is ample evidence that this was policy and that these behavioural scientists were drawn into trying to achieve this.
Yes. And the fifth finding, very quickly, no ethical input at all.
Right.
There was no ethical oversight of the production of these materials. In the words of the Cabinet Office, they didn't think that it was needed. They didn't think that any kind of ethical oversight was required in this instance.
Do you know, it doesn't surprise me, actually, because when I looked at that Influencing Behaviour, the Mindspace Way, that article that I mentioned earlier, I was looking, in fact, I did a little search through for ethical, moral, and it doesn't come up at all. There's nothing about it in there.
No, that's right. That's right.
It's just, this is how to do it, but not whether you should do it or to what extent you should do it. No, this is just how you do it. This is the science, and that's that.
Yeah, that's right. So the lack of ethics, I guess, wasn't surprising, but it was useful to confirm it, from the cabinet office's own words through freedom of information requests. They actually confirm that.
And I believe through freedom of information, you found out, or somebody found out, that the cabinet office approved a lot more money for the advertising, marketing, communications during COVID than it officially said. Is that right? I think it was 200 million or something. It was a lot more than that.
Yeah, there were some astounding figures for that, weren't there? I can't remember off the top of my head what the level was, but it was multi-millions of pounds spent on COVID advertising, of which a lot of it went towards these COVID-infused adverts, like the Look Them in the Eyes campaign.
So we were paying our taxes for those taxes to be then spent scaring us to death.
Well, yes, it's an irony there, isn't there? We're paying through our taxes for the government to covertly influence our behaviour.
For our own good, of course. That would be the thing, wouldn't it? It's for our own good.
Well, that's it. Socially responsible for the greater good. That's the collectivist kind of mantra, isn't it?
That's right, yes, yes. So somebody high up makes the decision as to what the greatest good is, and you just have to trust them that they always make the right decisions because they're not going to ask you.
That's right. You know.
Yeah, indeed. Well, you say we've got to close very soon, but I just wanted to finish with this little quote and ask you a last question. You say in one piece, regrettably for ordinary people, conscious deliberation prior to decision-making is rapidly becoming a rare commodity, and we are being furtively nudged on an unprecedented scale to obey the doctrines of the world's elite. And I'll add in there what I think you mean, the so-called world's elite. So this is a global problem. It is growing, and it is reducing our agency to make decisions in everyday life if we're not aware of this. I think a lot of people are not aware of this. So really, what's your advice? What can we do about this to try and improve this situation?
Well, yes, that's the key question, isn't it?
The million-dollar question, yeah.
It feels pretty helpless. I know I do at times, but then I go through phases when I get more optimistic. Mm. There are grounds for optimism. I think the dominant narrative, certainly around public health, is being challenged from a number of sources at the moment. Mm. And if we don't challenge the use of nudges per se, they will continue to be used in other areas, not just under public health banners, but under banners for climate change, war, pollution, often for the fulfillment of goals that are contentious.
Indeed.
And need to be openly discussed. As far as I change it, my bottom line with this, Julian, is always what will ultimately change is more and more people visibly dissenting to what's being done to them.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be a majority, I don't believe. I think, you know, if we had consistently 15 to 20% of the population visibly dissenting to, for example, the use of these nudge techniques, that would be sufficient to halt it. And by visibly dissenting, I don't mean being kind of on marches necessarily, or certainly not obviously advocating any violence or disruption in that regard, but just voicing dissent at every opportunity, whether it's, you know, in the pub, to family, friends, and the hairdressers. Opportunities arise more and more, I'm finding, to actually drop some information in. And if we have more people who can feel empowered to do that by being more aware of what's going on, and that's, I guess, what efforts like my own are aiming to achieve. Anything else on top of that's a bonus. If you can get, like I'm trying in the second half of the research, to produce like an optimal framework, ethical framework, to constrain government's use of these techniques in the future, and to try and get some government accountability using input from legal experts, et cetera, et cetera. If we get any success with that, that'll be great. But obviously, that's a big ask, trying to get governments to take heed of these things. Right. But it's worth a try. But the bottom line is, you know, there'll be something on the record, on the written record for future generations about what they did to us. But also, hopefully, we can inform increasing number of people about what's going on and what's continuing to happen. It's not over by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
If that empowers them to be a bit more kind of dissenting in a visible way, not hiding behind, you know, an anonymous identity on on Twitter.
Absolutely.
But actually, you know, in the flesh.
Yeah, yeah. And something I've heard recently from a number of people is turning up to council meetings and voicing your opinion. Mm-hmm. Very often councillors are going, what people are turning up? We didn't expect anybody to turn up to our meeting. You know, they've got so used to so being so complacent that nobody bothers about local things that are going on. And now you're getting dozens of people turning up saying, oh, we don't want this to be a low traffic neighborhood. Let's talk about this, you know, talk about it. You've got to be kidding. So it does have an impact.
Agree, yeah. We've been to a few local council meetings here.
Yeah. You've had that kind of response?
Yes, definitely. Most definitely. Yeah. People do just kind of, well, they're surprised at the turnout. Mm. Went to one a couple of weeks back, just in our local town,
right,
when far more people turned up than they expected because
right,
there were insufficient number of chairs. You know, they weren't expecting the numbers to start with. And within those numbers, there were quite some vocal dissent.
Excellent. Yes.
In that case, to the 15-minute cities kind of idea and some of the local government stuff, but I can identify with that.
Yes. Yeah. Were you smeared as right wing by any chance?
Well, not publicly, although
okay,
everything's right, labelled right wing.
Indeed.
At the moment, isn't it? It doesn't fit.
It is. It's nonsense. Yeah. Indeed. Okay, well, I'm very conscious of the time. We've just overrun, actually, and I'm very grateful to you for spending this time with us. Thank you ever so much, Dr. Siddeley, for having this conversation. It's fascinating and really interesting to hear about your latest research and how that's going and how that's informing about, you know, the situation as it is now, not just COVID, which is now kind of behind us, but we're still learning those lessons, aren't we, I hope, and remembering those lessons. And it would be great, if possible, to have another chat with you. You said, you know, about masks. You could chat about that in itself.
Absolutely, yeah.
Maybe we could do that sometime if you'd be up for that.
Definitely,
would you be up for that?
Definitely. Yeah. I'm doing a presentation in Edinburgh on Thursday night about masks and the actual key people responsible for masks in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And that flip-flop, you know, where all the experts change within the space of about 2 months, from don't wear masks if you're healthy in the community to mask mandates. So, yeah, I'd be more than happy to talk about that, Julian.
Excellent.
Close to my heart.
Yes, indeed, and to mine, because not only were they symbolic at the time of, you know, do as you're told and all that sort of thing, but they stand now, I think, of a symbol of that time and a symbol of that approach. And so I think it's useful to keep that in mind as we, you know, as we look at the situation as it is today as well. Even if they're not currently being used, they are a symbol of what's happening.
The most insidious of all the restrictions, in my view, the mask.
Yeah, I came to agree with that over time. Yes. Yeah. Okay, thank you ever so much for speaking with us. It's great to have spoken to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. Thanks for having me.
Show notes for this programme can be found at The Mind Renewed, themindrenewed.com, podcast music by the brilliant Anthony Rajakoff, attribution non-commercial share alike 4.0 international. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, and my guest, Dr. Gary Siddeley. And I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.